Colorado has a story to tell. From Glenn Miller to Diane Reeves, from the astronauts to the Lumineers, the Colorado Music Experience collects and preserves the legacy of Colorado's rich music history, serving as a resource for audio, visual, informational, and archival materials. Your host is G. Brown.
Our guest is Pernell Steen, in the eyes of many, the leading light of Colorado's jazz scene. A Denver native, a gifted member of an esteemed musical family, and a fixture for decades at clubs and festivals, he is also a scholar of the legendary Five Points neighborhood, the destination for jazz in the 1920s through the 50s. Welcome, Pernell.
Gee, it's a consummate pleasure. We've been trying to put this thing together since I had black hair, and that's way too long.
You were born and raised in Denver.
I was hatched on tax day 1941.
You got an early start studying music at the age of four?
It came from the man above, because if someone had said Porter Steen, that was my father's name, we will give you $1 million to hum the national anthem, he would still be a pauper. He could not find music anywhere. They made a mistake and gave me a toy piano, Christmas of 1944. I was three, and so I started playing around on it. The black keys were painted on, and my mother would listen to things like the Bell Telephone Hour, the Donald Voorhees Orchestra, etc. She said I would sit on the floor and try to replicate what I heard. When I couldn't do it, she said you howled like a little baby banshee. So she called our church organist. Her name was Catherine Coron, and she called and said, Catherine, would you please take Pernell as a student? And she said, Mrs. Steen, I don't take children until they are in school. My mother said, I won't last that long. So she took me to 2329 Emerson Street. I looked, and they had one of those old Victorian stools on a spindle, and they put about six books on it. And Mrs. Coron, she was a wonderfully benign sweetheart. She said, Pernell, give me your thumb. She placed my thumb on middle C, and she said, that's your best friend. And I started off with music lessons. I loved it because my mother could not have any more children. My piano became my surrogate sibling. I was a nerd. I practiced because I loved to practice. I remember saying to Mrs. Coron, someday when I'm a big boy, I will play the notes at either end of the piano.
Mm-hmm. You saw your cousin, bassist Charles Burrell, desegregate the Denver Symphony in particular and the orchestra world in general when you were 8 years old?
That is correct. See, my mother was very, very fair, and she passed for white, and most people thought that I was her maid's little boy, so recognizing that I was just absolutely gaga over music, she took me to the symphony when I was about 4.5, 5 years old. And she said, everybody looked at you expecting you to scream and holler. She said, you were mesmerized to a point where you didn't even get up and potty. She said, you lasted the entire symphony. So that momentous evening, Charles had been in Denver probably 3 months. He came by the house. He was fascinated that I was studying classical music. And he wanted to know where that came from. And my mother, whose name was Laverne, said, Charles, we don't know. They did not encourage it. They didn't discourage me. Of course, they encouraged me to study, but they didn't shove it down my throat. As I said, I was a pretentious symphony goer by that time. So that night in September of 1949, I was sitting there with my mom, and I looked on the stage, and I saw all of the musicians, and they were warming up. And I said, Mom, where's Charles? She said, he's coming. I said, I don't see him. And, you know, eight-year-olds get fidgety. I said, where is he? I was very insistent and very indignant. Finally, the door to the stage opened, and there was a bass framed in the door frame. And it didn't move for what seemed like an eternity. And then all of a sudden, the bass started moving, and I saw a brown hand. And as he slowly walked across the stage, he was ramrod straight in tails. I was so proud of him. I said, that's what I want to do in life. Then all of a sudden, there was a tepid applause. Some people said, yay. And then there were others who said, oh, my God, what's the world coming to? They hired a nigger. See, that still resonates 74 years later in my head. And my mother grabbed me, and she held me very tightly. In 1946, my mom was sick, and we went to California for the summer. And I went to the Coconut Grove Hotel, and I saw Nat King Cole. Keeping in mind that I had just started music lessons a year prior to that, Nat King Cole came out, and I was fascinated. Here's this dark coffee brown man with satin black hair who came out very elegantly in white tails, white shoes, white socks, and he sat down to a white piano. And the most beautiful sounds came out of the piano and also out of his voice. He became my immediate idol. I still wanted to play classical music, but I said, someday I want to wear tails. Well, in fast forwarding, 3 years later, my cousin does the same thing, but the roles are reversed. He's walking across the stage wearing black tails, and I watched him walk very, very slowly all the way across the stage. I had seen movies where somebody was making the last walk to the execution chamber, and that's what Charles looked like. And I was totally confused. I could not figure out why he was met with that kind of response, and people cheered Nat King Cole. I talked with Charles a lot about that. He finally said, well, there is a difference between the music that you saw Nat King Cole play and the music you saw me play with the symphony. Obviously, a major shade of difference, black and white. So I said, huh, the piano has black keys and white keys, and there's a majority of white keys on the piano, so the white music must be more important. I was trying to process this. Charles, God bless him, took me to see him play jazz. And I was more confused than ever because here he was as equally at home with jazz as he was with classical music. My brain was, I was too young. I was in high school, and that's when I realized this man was so immensely talented that he could cross the line of both genres of music.
You grew up in a neighborhood in Denver that was multiracial?
We grew up at 2135 Downing, and it was very interesting. The mothers were the daycare centers, and we had clotheslines. If Mrs. Smith were the black mother that day, she would throw an old sheet or a blanket over the clothesline, and we would play, and there would be maybe the one or two Japanese Americans who were not interred. This was in the 40s. There were a few Hispanics, or at that time, basically Mexicans. No one other than people from Mexico lived here because there wasn't that much of an international trade with Latin America. And then there were Anglos. So we played whatever we played, and regardless of anyone's ethnic background, we were just kids. It was a very interesting neighborhood. It wasn't completely, quote, all black, all Negro, but the majority of the neighborhood in Northeast Denver, that is the historic black neighborhood, because Negroes, African Americans, black people were redlined to that neighborhood and could not go outside of the boundaries of that neighborhood.
So when you got to high school, had to be eye-opening. You attended East.
I got to East High School because of Charles Burrell. When I saw Charlie play the bass violin, I wanted to play the bass violin also. My mother, who was height challenged, she was 4 feet 13 in heels, said, and who is going to carry it? Charles said, Laverne, why doesn't he study the violin? So he's the one who got me to start the violin with Sam Chernick, who was the first chair violinist of the second violin section. And Mr. Chernick was a very patient teacher and an excellent performer. So because I could already read music and I had the dexterity, all I really had to do was learn the fingerboard. I actually advanced 5 years in about 4 months. So I excelled at it. I went to Maury Junior High School at 13th and Clarkson, right across from St. John's Cathedral. And I was the first chair violinist in the orchestra there. Mr. John T. Roberts, a head of music for Denver Public Schools, had a younger brother, Roland Roberts, who was the band director and instrumental teacher at East High School. In order to showcase his brother's orchestra, I had a fictitious address to go to East High School. Mr. John Roberts came over to our house at 2140 Franklin Street. We just moved there from Downing. And he said, Mr. and Mrs. Steen, this is the address Purnell will use to get into East High School. So I had that for 2 years, and then after that, they couldn't throw me out of the school. But the racist school board superintendent, whose name was Kenneth Oberholzer Jr., who was a Texan, gerrymandered the boundaries to exclude black kids from East High School. So when I graduated June the 7th, 1959, there were 7 black kids out of 942 students in the graduating class of the mighty 59ers. The orchestra there was so superb. Kay Brainerd, who was a senior when I was a sophomore, did the Paganini Violin Concerto, and we accompanied her. She ended up teaching at the Eastman School of Music. Dick Downing, as a junior, he did the Grieg Piano Concerto, and we accompanied him, not one ringer at all. John Parsons, who was the solo cellist, did the Brahms Cello Concerto for his senior recital. We accompanied him. It was a most incredible group. There was no jazz for me. They didn't have a jazz program. I wanted to be a concert pianist or violinist. So upon graduation, I had a presidential scholarship to CU. Somebody said, why don't you audition to go to Juilliard? I said, okay, might as well, can't dance. And so I filled out the requisite papers, application forms, and I applied to Juilliard on piano, violin, and pipe organ. So I won the audition here in Denver and went to Chicago and auditioned in front of the panel there. And when they saw my suntan, they kind of looked at me with very jaundiced eyes. No, they were very stern. And I got this very tepid letter of rejection. We're full right now. In other words, they had a quota. Uh-huh. I told my mom, I said, well, you know what? I'm going to go to New York City. I'm going to wait tables and bartend until I get into Juilliard. Well, 17 minutes later, when I picked myself up off of the ground, she said, take your little skinny brown buns to Boulder where you have scholarship. After that, you can do anything you want. So I approached Warner Imig, who was at that time the dean of the College of Music. And I told Dean Imig that I wanted to get a degree in piano pedagogy and a BS in piano performance. And he said, Negroes don't play classical music. And this was 1959. By that time, Charles had left and was on his way to San Francisco. So being very respectful, the ivory tower realm of academia, guys said, my cousin Charles Burrell just finished 10 illustrious years with the Denver Symphony under the patronage of Maestro Saul Kasten. And he swung his head around like Linda Blair and said, we let him in and there'll never be another. So I did not get a degree in music from the University of Colorado. However, they had a thing called the Buffoons, which was a modern jazz choir. So I sang with Kenny Rogers.
Is it accurate to say that the story of black music in Denver began with George Morrison? George was sadly a bit of a footnote, never achieved his dream of playing with a symphony orchestra, but in the early 1900s, he led one of Denver's first jazz orchestras. He eventually toured the major cities in the West, yet every musician who knew or worked with him thought he was a genius. He played a major role in the career of so many musicians. I'm thinking of Jimmy Lunsford, the jazz saxophonist and a band leader in the swing era. Grew up in Denver, played with George Morrison, as did Andy Kirk.
Yeah, George Morrison was a classically trained violinist, of course, and his father played the Pantages vaudeville circuit in Missouri. They immigrated here before the turn of the 20th century, so his father, being a violinist, trained him. And Mr. Morrison, George, I'm speaking of, by the way, I will refer to him as Big Daddy because he's the only grandfather I ever knew. Both of my grandfathers predeceased my birth. So I grew up with him. His grandchildren and I grew up together. They called him Big Daddy, and I did too. So he auditioned to get into the old Denver Civic Orchestra under the patronage of Horace Tourman. Of course, he was rejected. he knew that he wanted to play music, so you're right. He put together a jazz band. There were territory bands, of course, and George Morrison had a territory band. All of the border states, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico, possibly northern Arizona, western Kansas. Keep in mind, 103, 104 years ago, these were still rough mining camps, and they brought music to these mining camps. So he started making money, and he had plucked this young lady who went to East High School from 1908 to 1911. 100 years ago, Mr. Morrison took his band from Denver, Colorado to London, England, and did a Royal Command performance for King George V, who was Queen Elizabeth's grandfather. Well, they returned. She was one woman amongst all the knuckleheads. She said, I'm sick and tired of this. I'm leaving. So she left the band. And she immigrated out to California. She started working, and she started doing a little theater. And in 1939, she also forever changed the landscape of the movies because her name was Hattie McDaniel, and she got the Oscar for portraying the role of Mammy in Gone with the Wind.
This segues into the nascent stages of Five Points.
Yes.
That neighborhood was ground zero for the Denver jazz scene from the 20s through the 50s.
Absolutely. And see, Five Points was actually the business district, the cultural district, the entertainment district of, quote, Negro East Denver. I compare the Black East Denver community to that of the mythical Mayberry from Andy Griffith fame because it was a self-contained neighborhood. We had two cab companies, and we had the number two oldest fire station in Denver right there at 25th and Washington, the Black Fire Station. Dr. Clayton Hawkins was an African-American physician. He had his office building on the corner of 25th and Washington. Dr. Clarence Holmes was a dentist who went to Howard University and was one of the nine co-founders of the NAACP. We had all these preeminent people. It was a self-contained community. In those days, early 40s, you had no need to go downtown Denver except to pay bills. In 1900, according to the U.S. Census, there were approximately 7,000 Negroes living in Colorado, of whom 5,000 were concentrated in Denver. So here was this very vibrant population. Every infrastructural concept that a community needed was there in, quote, Five Points or in East Denver. Think about this. Coming west from Kansas City on the way to the West Coast, the largest thing west of Kansas City on Highway 36 or 40 is Denver, Colorado, 612 miles away. So even though Kansas was admitted to the Union as a free state, a lot of the musicians fertilized the soil along the way because they could not get accommodations to stay. So all they could do would be to fill up their cars so that they could make this pilgrimage. And by the time they got to Denver, they found, whoa, this was Mecca, man. First of all, the air is clean. That was in those days. And look at this. We can actually walk down the streets and nobody's going to try to pull a gun on us. And this was Mecca, and they found this big community hungering for that stuff called jazz music. It became known amongst the jazz musicians, hey, man, if you're going west, stop in Denver. And that's how the Denver jazz community really grew.
Thank you. The Rossonian Hotel played host to Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald, Charlie Parker.
Certainly, it was a signature club of Denver, Colorado. And then the after-hours clubs were the ones that were a lot of fun. There was the Lils, where Charlie was the house band at the end of the 50s. And I went in there. Charlie, as two stepsons who were my contemporaries, we went in there underage, and everybody said, "Oh, that's Mr. Burrell's boys. You can let him in." And one night, there was a white guy sitting over in the corner, and they had two pianos, and he was playing a Wurlitzer bungalow piano, singing some blues, and all these real hip black cats came in. "Hey, man, how you doing? You better quit that. You're playing too colored, man. You better get a little hip." It was Mose Allison.
Oh, really? Wow.
That was about 1958. It was Mose Allison. And then there was a very animated gentleman there. He was Anglo, and he was always very heavily overpoured. It was, "Oh, man, this is some of the best music." And he was very raucous, exceedingly spicy. And he was always writing on either toilet paper or he'd tear a roll of paper towel. And he'd be sitting there swilling and writing. "Man, this is the Harlem of the West. This is the best damn music I ever." It was Jack Kerouac. These beady little eyes saw him. And we didn't know who Jack Kerouac was at the time.
I've seen that there were up to 50 clubs in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That might be stretched over that period of time.
Yes, because television ruined a lot of things. All of a sudden, you had entertainment in your living room. We did not get TV here until Christmas of 1951. They swore they couldn't get the lines over the mountains. Well, somehow they did. So dancing was really the mode of expression and exercise. And the casino, which is now Cervantes, oh, man, that's where you really see the big bands. Duke played in there. But there were clubs and small clubs all around, and there was always somebody singing or somebody playing locally. And in fact, there was a great alto sax player whose name was Beatty Hobbs. And the band leader begged Beatty to leave Denver and go on the road with him. And it was Dizzy Gillespie. And Beatty said no. He had a federal civil service job. He said, "I have mouths to feed, and I've got a paycheck. Thank you very much for the honor."
You come from a musical family beyond the legendary Charlie Burrell. Cousin Diane Reeves, the greatest jazz singer of a generation, 5-time Grammy winner, the late George Duke.
Held him on these knees in 1946 in Marin, California. He was 8 months old. And they said, "Don't drop the baby." And I didn't. And then George later on, he said, "Man, you've known me longer than Charles." He said, "Was I a good baby?" I said, "I wanted to take you on the train home with me." George and I were very, very close.
Phenomenal talent.
Yes.
Producer, keyboardist throughout the
arranger, yes.
70s and 80s. I just found out about your relation to Eddie Cleanhead Vincent.
I almost got killed. I did. It was 1959. I was going to school in Boulder. I was a church musician. I still am. And every Sunday, I had to commute to Denver and play for my church on Sunday mornings. Well, a bunch of us said, "Man, let's go to the casino. Man, they got these great bands there." So I saw this man, and he played the sax, and he started singing, and people were having a great time dancing. And I saw one of the church members from my church there, junior high school Sunday school teacher. The next day, as church ended, she had the unbridled sagacity to walk up to my mother and say, "I saw Purnell at the casino last night." Now, my mother, instead of saying to her, "And what were you doing there?" went into the immediate attack mode. The left hand went back, "Purnell Levant." Oh, God, what did I do? And she said, "What were you doing at the casino?" I started at warp speed, mumbling and stumbling over my... I said, "Oh, Mom, I went to see this band, and the band was really good, and he was singing some blues, and he played the saxophone, and it was Onion Head. He was a little skinny guy, and he played..." And she said, "What did you say?" I said, "They call him Onion Head. He's a little skinny guy. He's walnut brown. He's bald, and he smokes cigarettes, and he plays the saxophone." She said, "Cleanhead?" I said, "That's it." She said, "That's your cousin." And that's why I'm here speaking to you today. She was going to take me off of this planet. And he had forgotten that my mother actually raised him. He was about 12 years younger than my mom. His mother was my mother's aunt. So after that was settled, until he passed, every time he came to Denver, he stayed with my mom and dad. I sat in with Eddie down on 23rd and Stout. I wasn't playing jazz at that time. I was just still learning. He was called one of the Texas blues shouters, but he was very quiet. And he's like, hey, come on here, little pup. That man, he can't even play. He didn't know what he's doing. And Ed could not read music at all. He was a guest lecturer at UNC. So we drove up to Greeley in the 80s. Here were these music students, and they said, well, Mr. Vincent, man, you played this scale, and we noticed that you did a sharp 7 and a flat 5. And he said, man, I don't know what you're talking about. I just play what I hear. And he shared things with me, just how to act on a bandstand, told me something that Charles reinforced. He said, never get up and attempt to play something you don't know, because you'll fail. He said, if you barely know it, don't play it. Master it.
I'm a midnight creeper. You know, I'll slip right up on you. I'm a midnight creeper. You know, I'll slip right up on you.
In your 20s, you were in the middle of the civil rights movement, a bit of an activist. You got to meet Robert F. Kennedy at one point, the Attorney General.
Yeah, I was at the March on Washington in 63.
Tour of duty during the Vietnam War.
Yes, I was very fortunate. I went to Vietnam on what was called TDY, it was temporary duty. I became the grade legal specialist, and I started doing court martials and so forth. And then I got sent to Vietnam to help clear up the backlog of incarcerees in Saigon. We worked almost 20 hours a day. It was kangaroo justice, really was. And then I got sent to Germany. I was doing the same thing, although the weather has changed. Instead of 115 degrees and 95% humidity, it was cold and raining. Here I was typing out court martial papers on a rickety typewriter in a leaking tent, freezing. And I said, this is not made for me. And so I called the home of George Morrison's grandson, George Bailey. I called the 7th Army Soldiers Corps headquarters in Heidelberg, and I got this wonderful person. I said, I'd like to speak to Specialist George Bailey. He said, oh, you can't, they're in Berlin on tour. I said, that's where I'm supposed to be. So surely enough, I auditioned, and I got into that unit, which was amazing. We toured every NATO country in Western Europe at that time.
Now God bless cowboys and God bless gold. God bless my uncle and rest his soul. He taught me well, boys, taught me all I know. Taught me so well that I grabbed the gold. And I left him laying there by the side of the road.
You studied with Dr. Antonia Brico?
Uh-huh. Piano. In fact, Judy Collins still owes me money.
Judy, another legend who studied with Dr. Brico. And
went to East High School together. She's 2 years older. Judy had a lesson immediately preceding mine. As Archie Bunker would say, I had to scrub turlets to pay for get these little brown hands chafed. I had the very last lesson that Dr. Brico taught that particular day of the week. I never got my half an hour, and at that time, Dr. Brico's lessons were $7.50 a half an hour, which in today's money equates to $75 a half an hour. And I was also in her orchestra, the Denver Businessmen's Orchestra, which morphed into the Brico Symphony.
And that's where Judy made her debut as a teenager with the Businessmen's Orchestra.
Most people don't know that she is a classically trained pianist. She plays 12-string banjo, 12-string guitar. Yeah, and she's a sweetheart. In fact, Judy, upon graduation, her first gig was at Hal Neustadter's Exodus, which was at the corner of 20th and Lincoln. And she was there in between the Smothers Brothers and Sonny and Cher. Yeah.
Wow. Has she mentioned paying you back?
Yeah, right. No, I never. She's so wonderful. My cousin, God bless him, got me a scholarship in 1956 to study violin in Aspen at the Aspen Summer Music Camp. I auditioned for it. I was studying violin with the principal violinist of the Juilliard String Quartet. This was before Buckminster Fuller built the building, so we were out there in the meadow playing the violin in mud. It was cold, alpine, 10,000-foot rainstorms, etc. This was the third year of the venerable Aspen Jazz Festival. It was held for 3 days. In 1956, they had two pianists, Teddy Wilson and Oscar Peterson. So I hung around, and Oscar was playing, and the crowd kept saying, "Get Louise up." And he said, "What?" They said, "Get Louise up." And he got irritated. Louise Duncan got up. Let me back up. I wanted to learn jazz. I wanted to play A Foggy Day in London Town. And Charlie sent me to her house to study jazz with her. She couldn't read music. She had hands the size of polar bear paws. Keep that in mind. She's very humble. She always sounded as though she were on the verge of tears. And she said, "Honey, I don't know why Charlie sent you to me. I don't know what I'm doing." I said, "I love what you don't know." I learned her version of A Foggy Day in London Town, chord by chord. It took me a full month. Back to Aspen, "Get Louise up." Louise Duncan got up and she played her signature version of T for Two, which she did at warp speed, and she modulated every four bars. People were screaming and hollering, and he said, "Who in the hell are you? I don't know who the hell you are, but damn, you can play." After I got out of the service, I stayed in Europe, and my best buddy, George Bailey, George Morrison's grandson, George also went to the New York School of Fashion Design. He's a great artist. So we decided we're going to open a boutique shop in Heidelberg. Two little chocolate children from Denver. And we found a crooked partner, of all things. Our German friend said, "Come with us. You're about to go to jail." So they dragged us from Heidelberg to Stuttgart, and the Stuttgart Ballet was looking for a pianist to run the ballet school. And I said, "George, go." I had to drag him to the audition. He finished the audition, and they said, "Can you start tomorrow morning?" They were fascinated, and he only worked for them 44 years. Then I ended up working for a subsidiary of Nestle. And I stayed there until my mom got sick and I had to come back. I was in the oil and gas business. And then it collapsed in 81. I had to do something, so I started playing cocktail lounge piano on Larimer Square.
You're a lifelong Denver sports fan.
Yes.
Denver Broncos fan in particular.
I went to the very first Broncos game. My classmate, Bob Housem Jr., his father bought the franchise and created it. We were in Boulder, and Bobby said, "You want to go to a football game on Sunday?" I said, "Yeah." So I said, "Wait a minute. CU's not playing on Sunday." He said, "No. Dad bought a team." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, this is called the Broncos." I said, "You know, I'm a poor scholarship student." He said, "We need butts and seats." And he gave me two free tickets. And we beat the
Boston Patriots
13-10. So then, years later, of course, my blood still ran orange, and Ari Taylor, who was a Colorado legislator, put together the East Denver Broncos Club, which was an all-African-American club. They had enough people to charter at least one 707, sometimes two, and they always wanted to go to the Kansas City game, A, because it was close. Kansas City was one of our greatest rivals, and then because it was in Kansas City, they could bring back some good barbecue. So I took the seat of a good friend who did not fly. I told my mom and dad, I said, "I'll bring you back some barbecue." And I went to Gates, and they very properly wrapped a half a dozen slabs. And you think I was going to put them in a baggage hole? Heck no. I put them in the overhead. And, of course, people go,
yeah.
All of a sudden, there was this riot on the verge of starting. We got peanuts and cocktails. Well, I was the last person getting off the plane, carrying my stash back to the carousel. And I saw this old guy with his beat up cowboy boots on, short guy, and he had this all banged up guitar around his neck, and the guitar was held together with duct tape. And he had his hat, and I think a bear tried to chew on the crown or something, because it was holy, it was greasy, it had character. And he said, "Man, that's some good smelling barbecue you got there." And I looked over, I said, "Hey, Wilster, come over in the corner." It was Willie Nelson. I gave him a slab of ribs. I love me some Willie Nelson. Oh, of course I gave Willie some cue. That's when he lived up here in Evergreen. I played with him at Little Bear one night and had to sing some blues, of course, and had us a good time. Had a darn good time.
That's where the light and the dark folks meet. I have an on earth, they call it Basin Street. I said, Basin Street. It's a street where the elite always meet down in New Orleans.
You've been a regular on the Denver music scene for decades now, playing in venues like Dazzle, the Burnsley Hotel.
Yeah, City Park Jazz Festival, Five Points Jazz Festival, Juneteenth, Estes Park Jazz Festival. We played Red Rocks when Wellington had his Jazz on the Rocks. I had the Mile High All-Stars with Charlie Burrell on bass. We played Vail Jazz Festival. Yeah, we've done a little bit.
Purnell Steen and Le Jazz Machine. Was there a particular genesis to that group?
I got a call from National Jewish Hospital. They were doing a big fundraiser. I was working in Larimer Square, and one of the customers was on the board of NJH and said, "Hey, Purnell, we want you to bring your band." I said, "Sure. What band?" So I put this band together, and I said, what would I call a band? The Jazz Machine. And somebody from Kubo said, "No, that name is already trademarked." I think it might have been Elvin Jones. I said, "Well, since I'm named after Oscar Levant, that's my middle name, after the great pianist," I said, "Purnell Steen and Le Jazz Machine. Because a machine is a sum of its parts, so I'll have all these good guys." Because Denver is off of the national, international information grid, we have all of these unsung heroes, these great musicians and other artists who live here in obscurity.
You've recruited some of the greatest players in the country, much less Denver, to play with you. You had a rhythm section to beat all when you were playing with Kevin Smith on drums and Ron Bland on bass and Ed Steven on guitar. That's like having Wes Montgomery living down the block, right?
Thank you. November the 4th, 2018, Dazzle, the first Saturday of the month. And it was called Pancakes with Purnell. And there was a person right in my sight line. Fingers were keeping time with the music. And I said, "Whoever this person is, I've got to meet him." You know, I'm very shy, right? The band took a break and they said, "Hey, Vaughn, how are you?" I said, "Do you know him?" They said, "We played on the soundtracks of his last three movies." And that's how I met Vaughn Regensburger. Truly, we have this very spiritual connection. I had been searching for the last piece of my musical quilt, and he is that piece. And his mom said to me one day, "You hired Vaughn and you had never heard him play." I said, "I didn't need to. I knew that if they gave him that kind of endorsement, he was a winner." And then the most beautiful thing happened to me. I announced in December of 2018 that the San Francisco Symphony was honoring Charles, celebrating the 60th anniversary of his historic debut with them, 10 years after he'd been here. And I said, "Well, Charles is too frail to fly, so I'm being sent there as his personal rep." And Vaughn Regensburger walked up to me. We'd only known one another 5 or 6 weeks. Very, very humbly asked, "I'll pay my way. May I please go along with you?" And we got to San Francisco. The San Francisco Symphony honored Charles for 3 consecutive days. Vaughn and I got back to the hotel. Charles's 2 daughters from Los Angeles were there. Vaughn has a 10-foot-wide wingspan. he grabbed and encompassed the two daughters and me, and he said, I know what my next project has to be. He wasn't looking at us. He was staring off somewhere in future. He said, I must do a film on the life of Charles Burrell. And he said it with such conviction, and I'm here to tell you, it got completed.
He did it.
He did it. He done it. And his mother said something that was so poignant to me. She said, I'm so glad you became friends before you became brothers. And on that note, I can't say any more.
With the Five Points Ambassadors, you are keeping the legacy of the neighborhood alive. Musically, you're keeping a style alive, too. I've seen it described as Basie and Ellington and Tin Pan Alley composers and a little Wild West spirit in there.
Yeah, we're the only ones who are keeping the African-American and historical footprint of Five Points alive. And I am so proud to be a Denverite. I feel as though it's up to me to impart enough of my knowledge to the youngsters coming up who live here so that they will know at least something about the legacy of Five Points and realize that they don't have to go to New York City. Jazz in Denver, Colorado is just as good as jazz in New York City. Lady from Kansas City came in to Dazzle one Saturday morning. She gave me some attitude. Ha, jazz in Denver, huh? I said, yes, ma'am. I'm from Kansas City. You're going to have to go a long way to beat us and so forth.
You had to be a Chiefs fan, too.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And at the end, she came up. She said, I didn't expect anything this good. When can we get you in Kansas City? I said, when you give me enough money.
Yeah.
She said, you got some great. I said, yes, ma'am. We have some dynamite musicians who happen to live here.
Mm-hmm. Race doesn't always go to the swift. We'll
Thank
keep at
you.
It, right?
That's right.
Pernell, what's your favorite musician's joke?
This is actually not a joke. The truth is funnier than fiction. There is a beautiful song entitled Slow Hot Wind. We're playing at the Old Dazzle on 9th and Lincoln. I was portraying this. I was setting it up to Andrew Hudson. I said, I want you to close your eyes. You are somewhere in North Africa at one of the oases. You are looking into a limpid pool of deep blue water, and your body is awash by a slow, hot wind. And Andrew said, sotto voce, that's what I get when I have a double tacorito. Gotcha.
All right, buddy.
Well, guess.
The Colorado Music Experience is a nonprofit educational and cultural organization, relying on financial support from music enthusiasts to fund its initiatives. To learn more, please visit colomusic.org. colomusic.org.